Well, the last citywide, we began to look at Mark chapter 4, verse 35 through to the end of chapter 5. We saw in this passage that we were encountering four miracles of Jesus. But as we saw, the miracles were more than just these neat tricks that Jesus was performing, demonstrating his uniquely divine power. But really more, they were symbolic acts. They were what we called these acted parables, deeds that Jesus was performing specifically in order to reveal deeper truths about himself. Now, due to the time and the citywide, we looked at just the first two of these four miracles. And I said that later I would come back and podcast about the second two, which is what this teaching is about here. So if you've not listened to those first two teachings, part one of Mark 4:35 to chapter 5, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to that first. It will help you to more fully track with what this passage is happening about here. Now, before we read the second part of this passage with these two miracles, we need to remember a couple of things. First of all, we need to remember that these miracles are all taking place on the same day as the events that had preceded right back to Mark chapter 2. And specifically what we saw that was that in Mark chapter 2, it begins, remember, with Jesus getting in these six fights with the teachers of the law until finally Jesus is being referred to as being one that is in team with Satan by the Pharisees and by the teachers of the law in that day. It would have been a devastating claim. And the rest of the passage then is very much about Jesus responding to the Pharisees, responding to what they've said, but he's also now going to clarify and articulate who he sees himself to be. And he does this clarifying we saw in the last teaching through these miracles. These two teachings that we're encountering again today, these two miracles, I should say, are further to this. They're further about Jesus identifying for people with eyes to see who he understands himself to be. The teachers of the law, the Pharisees have articulated who they think, and now Jesus, through these miracles, is going to reveal who he understands himself to be. The second thing that we saw, though, was that these four miracles are very closely connected to the Old Testament. As with all of the Gospels, there are all these tendrils, these links that link back to the broad story that came before Jesus. And the more we know about that story, the more that we can rightly interpret what Jesus is doing in the Gospels. Specifically, these miracles that we saw were very closely connected to Isaiah 63 to 65. It was just this profound section of the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, where he begins to tell Israel about how one day God was going to come to Israel. For that matter, God was going to come into all creation. And when he came, he was going to come in order to bring a work of deliverance into the world, to rescue the world from its terrible condition, to rescue the world and bring it into a place of rightness, or the Hebrew word shalom, which we translate peace. Well, once again, in these latter two miracles that we're looking at, the same thing is happening. Isaiah is being linked to. And so in order for us to fully understand this miracles that we're looking at here today, we need to jump back into Isaiah again and look at a couple of specific passages. First passage is found in Isaiah chapter 64, verse 6. Here in this section, the prophet mentions that Israel's sins, the state that they are in, have become like filthy menstrual cloths, and that they need to be cleansed from these things. Now, that's quite a powerful image, perhaps one that we don't fully comprehend in our day and age, but ancient Israelites certainly would have understood it. In ancient Israel, the monthly flow of blood from a woman was something that the Old Testament said made her spiritually unclean, and that she needed to be removed from the people until the blood stopped. Well, as we've talked in the past, even in these teachings in Mark's Gospel, it seems strange to call something natural, such as a menstruation, as unclean. But it was intended to reveal a very deep and important truth to Israel. Month in, month out, they were reminded of this truth. Namely, God was vividly reminding them that their unclean state was something that came from within them, and that there was nothing that they could do about it. Like a monthly flow of blood that voluntarily came from a woman, so the sinful reality of human was something that just voluntarily came from within them, and there was nothing they could do to clean themselves or to stop it from coming. But we see here, in using this image, Isaiah, while reminding the people that their sins were like these menstrual cloths, he was also saying that when God came to his people, that he would come and deliver them from their unclean state. That though there was nothing that they could do about it on their own, that God one day was going to come, and when he came, he was going to be the one that would deliver them from their spiritually unclean state. It's a very profound image when you see it in this light. And so we have to ask the question, well, how is this passage of Isaiah connected to the miracles, the signs that we're about to see? And I think as we read through it, you'll begin to see the links are very apparent and very clear. Now, the other passage from Isaiah is Isaiah 65, verses 19 to 20. Remember, in this section, there's all of these links that go back to our, or that connect into our miracles today. Well, Isaiah 65 and 19 to 20, in this passage, Isaiah is mourning with Israel. He's mourning with creation over the very difficult life that they find themselves in. He's grieving at how hard the world is, at all of the brokenness that causes pain in the world. But in these verses, he also then begins to talk in light of hope about how when God comes to his people, he was going to make things right. He was going to make the world whole. Specifically, though, he announces that when God comes, no longer will people bear children destined to misfortune. That's what he says. And no longer will the sounds of weeping and crying happen. Again, it's this profound image that when God comes, especially in that culture where so many children were born to misfortune, where so many children even were dying in childbirth or were dying shortly thereafter, and then all of the sounds of weeping as the parents and others around in the community would cry over the loss of this children. It's a profound image to think that Isaiah is saying one day when God comes, he is going to go about the work of making all of that pain right. And so we ask again the question, well, how is this section of Isaiah going to link into the miracles that we see Jesus doing today? And I think, again, as we read through the passage, you'll see how apparent the links all really are. So with that little bit of background, let's read the stories then, and then dig into them and see what they all have to say to us. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him, and a woman was there who had been subjected to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around the crowd and he asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding around against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask who touched you?" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid. Just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jairus saw a commotion, with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and he said this to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand, said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. Okay, so here we are, still in the same scene as come before and the two miracles before. Jesus again, once again, crosses over the lake, and immediately he is met by one of the synagogue rulers, a man named Jairus. Now, it's an interesting detail, because we're prone to think by this point that all of the religious leaders were bad people or were people that were opposed to Jesus, and oftentimes they were. But on a few occasions, we meet some of these religious rulers that are not, that instead are very open or very eager to understand Jesus, and this is one of those places. Clearly, Jairus respected Jesus. Right away, he falls at his feet and he pleads with him. He knows that Jesus is someone that is unique with unique power. And it's another case where we see where people are pleading before Jesus. We've seen this throughout these stories before. And this has been the standard response of these stories. The disciples, the demons, and now Jairus, they're all seen pleading before Jesus. Clearly, they recognize something in him, something that is unique. And it makes me wonder how often we find ourselves in a similar response before Jesus today. How often do we find ourselves before Jesus pleading out for him, recognizing that there is something unique in him? Or is he just a guy that we, you know, come to from time to time? Well, the man is in desperate shape, because his daughter is sick and she's dying. Remember Isaiah? Here he is, Jairus. He's a man and he has a daughter that is destined to misfortune. And so he pleads for Jesus to come so that she will live. It's this key word, we see it so often, that she will live. The ruler understands that in Jesus, he is the one that holds the keys to life. He knows this about Jesus. And we'll see as the story progresses how this theme is developed. Well, as Jesus begins to go to the home of Jairus, a large crowd begins to press in around him. And the crowd there was a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. Now, 12, that's an interesting detail. As we learn, the woman had spoken to everyone, all the doctors, all the spiritual healers, whoever it was, but no one could fix her, and she just kept getting worse and worse, 12 years into it. And we don't know what exactly the condition was, but clearly it was some type of hemorrhaging that had resulted in a never-ending menstrual flow. And again, we think of Isaiah 63. And the prophet likening Israel's sin to menstrual cloths. Now here we have a woman, a daughter of Israel, so to speak, who has had these cloths for all of these years. Years of a discharge coming from her. Years of something that she can do nothing about. Years of uncleanness. Years of having others and trying to have others fix her. But years of not being able to do anything with her condition, with her physical condition, and with her spiritually unclean state. And then back to the detail, this number 12. It says she's been hemorrhaging for 12 years. Now, that might not be a big deal were it not for the fact that in the next story, when we finally reach Jairus' daughter, the same number is being mentioned. Two times in a row, two women are associated with this number 12. You see, this is Israel's number. The 12 tribes of Israel. Israel is always marked by the number 12. Do you see what's happening here? In other words, might this woman, and even the woman that come, the girl to come, represent more than just a woman or more than just a girl in need? Might they represent Israel in need? And for that matter, a creation in need. And an Israel that is in need in a very deep way, and a creation that is in need of a very, very deep way. An Israel that, like this woman, has suffered for years and years and years within an unclean state that was just coming from within them, coming from within Israel, and that no one had the power to do anything about it. No one could fix it. No one. The woman, the daughter of Israel, Israel is in need, clearly in need, but no one can do anything about it. Well, in the state, she's desperate, and she surmises that Jesus now is going to be her only hope. Interesting. And she thinks, well, if I can just touch his robe, then I'll be healed. Now, that's a risky proposition. A woman was not to touch a man in public, let alone a religious man. And the hem of the robe carried great significance in Israel. It was a place of authority. The priests and the kings all had their robes, or the hems of their robes, lavishly adorned, showing in public the significance of the person within those robes. But the woman knows that this is now her only hope. She knows that she has no other choice, and so she reaches out in this desperate move. Maybe Jesus is the one that can heal her from this never-ending flow of spiritually unclean state. Maybe he can reverse her unclean state and make her right. Maybe he can be the one that can finally restore her, make her whole, return her to her family, return her to her community. She's been on the outside ever since the blood started to flow, removed from people, like the demonized man we saw in the miracle before, living in the tombs. She's been on the outside looking in, unclean. No one could help her. And as she touches him, it says that immediately power went out from him, and the woman was healed. Jesus knew what happened, and he turned and he asked her, who touched him? The woman steps forward, and again we see this trembling response. She's afraid. She's aware that her risk may have backfired, even though she knows that she's being healed. And she's ready for scorn now from this religious man. But she's also aware that the man before her has just healed her, that this is clearly someone that is special. And so she falls at his feet, just like all the other stories, in a tense moment. But rather than scorn for breaking the rules, he looks at the woman and he commends her. I want you to imagine this. She's just broken the rules in Israel. She's just broken the rules with a holy man. Think about all the Pharisees that we've seen already and how scrupulously they deal with rules. But in the act, another holy man, Jesus, sees the woman who at this point now has valued faith in him and belief in his power more even than abiding by religious rules. And he commends her for this. There is a lesson here. Again, we see this theme that we've already seen in Mark's Gospels another time. Jesus is more concerned about keeping people than he is about keeping religious rules. That's one of the professors at Regent College in Vancouver often speaks about this, Rick Watts. Jesus is more concerned about keeping people than keeping religious rules. He delights more when we live in faith and in trust than when we live bound by sacred rules. Now, isn't that the opposite, so much of the opposite of what so many have learned in church about Jesus and about God? We've been told that what God values most is that we follow a religious codebook and that we do so scrupulously. But what we see in Jesus is that what he values most is that we live lives that are dependent on him, lives that are willing to abandon and all in the pursuit of him. It reminds me, I've been listening to this radio station recently in Vancouver. I don't even know why, but it's been on the radio, but it's this religious station where all of these people are on preaching sermons. And what occurred to me the other night when I was listening to it was that so many of the sermons were all directed toward what other Christians were doing wrong. It was all about this group isn't worshiping right, or this group isn't acting the way that they should. This group isn't approaching God in the right manner. And I was listening the other night, and it just was grieving my heart because I was realizing what part of this does it have to do with Jesus? Is Jesus more concerned that we're doing everything religiously right, or is he more concerned that we're throwing our lives at him, saying, oh, Son of God, could you heal me? the end of the day, I don't know that God is going to care about how closely we have got everything right, but I think he's going to care a lot about whether or not we threw our lives before his grace and threw our lives before his mercy and said, oh God, would you be favorable toward me? Well, so she walks away. And she has no longer any need of the filthy rags. She's been made whole. She's been shalomed by Jesus. It's a miracle about a woman being healed, yes, but it's more than this. Do we see what's happening here? The woman is being healed, but more so now, Jesus is announcing, I have come to fulfill Israel's hope. I have come to heal Israel. I've come to heal creation. Like Isaiah promised, the deliverer has now come and his name is Jesus. And he has come to set people free from their sin and he's come to release them into wholeness. It was a sign about Jesus. He was not Beelzebub as the leaders had said. He was Messiah. He was coming to fulfill the great hopes that Isaiah had put into the people. The time had now come. Go in shalom, go in peace, and be freed from your suffering. Well, with this, the story resumes back to Jairus and his daughter. In the interlude with the hemorrhaging woman, some of Jairus' men had arrived only to inform the ruler that his daughter had now died and that she shouldn't bother the teacher anymore. There's that title again, teacher. Remember, it's what the disciples used for Jesus when they feared for their lives in the storm in the first miracle. How they saw him, we saw, made all the difference. Well, here these men again perceive that Jesus is just a teacher, and so they feel that he shouldn't be bothered any longer. But what if they saw him as more? What if they saw him as the one that could raise the dead? Maybe that would have changed their response. And again, we see how Jesus ends up and how we see Jesus ends up making all of the difference. Well, Jesus, of course, he knows who he is. And so he looks back at the man and commands the man to not be afraid. Like the disciples were on the boat when they saw him just as a teacher, but instead to be a man that believes. In other words, what I just saw and what you just saw in the bleeding woman and what I just saw in the bleeding woman, I need to see in you. I need to see that kind of faith. She knew who I was, Jesus is looking at the man. She knew I was her only hope, and she had this bold faith that reached out in the crowd, and I want to see that in you now, Jairus. I want you to have some faith. Don't be afraid. Well, from here now, he separates the group. It's interesting. We're not sure why. And he opts just to take along his three closest disciples, James, John, and Peter. And as he arrives at Jairus' home, he's met with this loud commotion. People are crying and they're wailing loudly. And when we hear this, again, are we not reminded of the words of Isaiah? That in the day of the Lord, the sound of wailing would be no longer. Well, hearing their crying, he assures the crowd that the little child is not dead, but asleep. And what's Jesus meaning here? There are probably many interpretations, but whatever the case, the crowd didn't believe him and they laughed him off. They knew she was dead. They had seen dead before. Lots and lots of dead they had seen. Lots of dead children, for that matter. In the first century, records indicate that 60% of all children died by the time they were in their mid-teens. And we again remember Isaiah's words that one day the Lord would come and he would put an end to burying the children destined to misfortune. Putting the unbelieving crowd out of the house, he then looked at the parents. The disciples were with them, and they went into where the child was. She was 12 years old. There's that number again. And taking the girl by the hand, he spoke to her in Aramaic, Talitha kum, which means tenderly, get this, little lamb, get up. And she did. The shepherd had raised the lamb to life. Little lamb, get up. And at this, everyone, it says, was completely astonished. They had seen miracles before. They had seen miracles even in other people beyond Jesus. But they had never seen this. This was resurrection. Isaiah said that in the day of the Lord's coming, the wailing would stop, that it would be exchanged for dancing, and no longer would little children be born to misfortune. The miracle with Jairus' day was not just a miracle. Again, it was a sign like the three miracles before. It was a sign the day had come. The day they were all longing for. Isaiah's servant, Isaiah's great Messiah, God incarnate, was standing before them. As he called the crazed tomb dweller out of the graves, now he had come to speak to Israel, bound in death. Remember, the little girl is also marked by the number 12. She is also here to represent Israel, an Israel that is bound in death, an Israel that had no power over death, an Israel that no one could fix, and for that matter, an Israel caught in death, just like all of creation was caught in death. And Jesus comes and he says to this creation, "My little lambs, it's time to get up." This Jesus was the God of resurrection hope. And he had come to offer this resurrection hope to Israel, yes, but more, he had come to offer this hope to all of creation. And the only question, would we, will we, laugh at him, scoffing at his absurd commands, or will we join in and believe? Do you see the Jesus that Mark wants us to see in this miracle? This isn't just any teacher. This certainly isn't the team made of Beelzebub. By this point, that much should be clear, but this is the one who speaks to the dead Israel, to a dead creation, to dead people like you and me, and to these people. He says to us with this great power and great joy, "My little lambs, it's time to get up. It's time to get up out of your death. It's time to get up out of your sickness. It's time to get up out of your brokenness. My little lambs, it's time to get up." And after hearing this and seeing this and reading this in Mark's gospel, don't you just love him and long for him even more? I hope you do. That's my prayer in this teaching. And if you do, why not join everyone else in these stories and get on your knees for a moment? This isn't just a teacher. This is the one that Isaiah promised. This is the one who holds absolute command and authority. And because of this, like we talked in the last teaching, we should share this righteous tension. On the one hand, we should tremble before him with a true knee-knocking fear. We don't often talk about this, but it's true. This is the right response before Jesus. We see it in every story. He's not just a cuddly daddy who fixes our bumps while handing us this never-ending supply of cotton candy. In every story Mark presents to us, the people, even those that know him, are seen afraid and they are seen trembling before him. They do so because they recognize that when they look at him and they see his power displayed, that they are standing before someone the likes of which they have never before seen. This is the one who holds the keys to life and death, and they know it. And so they intuitively know that before him, the right place is on their knees, afraid. And as we see him, if we see him the way the ones in the story do, we'll not treat him profanely or glibly or nonchalantly. We'll not pretend that he's not there, that he's not the ruler of all creation, that he's not the ruler of our lives. We'll recognize our place before him and we'll be filled with a holy fear. This is the right response before Jesus. But on the other hand, we should also, though, on the one hand, we tremble. There should be this compulsion within us where we long to go, to be with him, because we also know that he is good and that everything that he does for us is for our good. He is the one that calms the seas. He is the one that dresses us up and makes us whole. He is the one who rids us of our filthy state. A state that we have no control over, a state that we cannot fix on our own. And he is the one who speaks tenderly to us again and again out of a death that we cannot control. He is the one that as we tremble before him, that he looks back at us and he says, "My little lambs, it's time to get up." He says this to us in our spiritual death, and one day he has promised that he will say it to us in our physical death. My little lambs, it's time to get up. Talitha kum, it is time to get up. Reminds me of C.S. Lewis in the Chronicles of Narnia. In the story, the children run into Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, and Lucy and Oliver, you know, wide-eyed enthusiasm and just wanting to know, she begins to inquire to Mr. and Mrs. Beaver about Aslan, the great lion of the wood, Jesus figure in the story. And I want to conclude just with the words of their exchange. Is he a man? Asked Lucy. Aslan? A man? Said Mr. Beaver sternly. Certainly not. I can tell you he is king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond sea. Don't you know who is the king of the beast? Aslan is a lion. The lion. The great lion. Oh, said Susan. I'd thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. That you will, dearie. And no mistake, said Mrs. Beaver. If there is anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly. Then he isn't safe? Said Lucy. Safe? Said Mr. Beaver. Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you.